Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, former Vice President Al Gore joins us live. Plus, an Oscar night disagreement preview from our movie day team, Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, who will disagree on some of the nominees. I'll even disagree, and more. And we'll get going right after this one brief reminder that we are in the cold, dark days of our winter membership drive. But you can warm them up by donating something to help us run the radio station. You can do it anytime at WNYC.org or call 1-888-376-WNYC. Thank you for calling 1-888-376-9692 or going to WNYC.org to support the station. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And joining us first today, with 1 week to go before this month's fiscal cliff, known as the sequestration budget, is John Meacham, executive editor at Random House, former editor-in-chief of Newsweek and co-host of Need to Know on PBS, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His latest book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. And John, thanks so much for doing this today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
And it seems like everybody in the Obama administration is out warning the public about different pieces of the sequestration budget. And I want to start by playing about a minute and a half of the president himself from earlier this week. And I don't think I've ever heard anything like this from a president. It was just a minute, 20 seconds of a list. And this is basically a doomsday list that focuses mostly on law enforcement and public safety. But let's listen.
Now, if Congress allows this meat cleaver approach to take place, it will jeopardize our military readiness. It will eviscerate job-creating investments in education and energy and medical research. It won't consider whether we're cutting some bloated program that has outlived its usefulness or a vital service that Americans depend on every single day. It doesn't make those distinctions. Emergency responders, like the ones who are here today, their ability to help communities respond to and recover from disasters will be degraded. Border Patrol agents will see their hours reduced. FBI agents will be furloughed. Federal prosecutors will have to close cases and let criminals go. Air traffic controllers and airport security will see cutbacks, which means more delays at airports across the country. Thousands of teachers and educators will be laid off. Tens of thousands of parents will have to scramble to find childcare for their kids. Hundreds of thousands of Americans will lose access to primary care and preventive care like flu vaccinations and cancer screenings.
President Obama earlier this week, and John Meacham, do you have an opinion on whether it'll really be as bad as all that, or is much of the rhetoric here a negotiating tactic to get the best deal from the Republicans that the president can get?
I think, as so often in politics, the truth is somewhere in between. I commend the president, though, for really taking this fight and making it specific. A lot of folks, including me, have, in the last 4 years or so, been critical of the president for not punching hard enough, for leading from behind, as the phrase often goes. And here he is out there making a case. And if it's exaggerated in its details, which it may or may not be, there's the old joke about the close the Washington Monument principle, that whenever the National Park Service is threatened with anything, they say, well, we'll have to close the Washington Monument and no one will ever be able to see it again. And that gets all the congressmen upset. But the president is mounting a political attack over a policy debate. And I know there's been some talk about, well, he shouldn't be doing that. He shouldn't be going to the country. I think that's precisely wrong. I think the president should go to the country. I think that there's a noble tradition. It's really kind of a Jacksonian tradition. He was the first president, really, to go over the heads of the establishment and make popular appeals when he took on the Bank of the United States way back in 1832. And it was an entrenched interest. He was having a hard time getting what he wanted within the established ways of Washington. And so he wrote a veto message and then sent it out around the country in much the same way for its time. Mm-hmm. President Obama's speech was there. So as awful as these crises by appointment are, which, by the way, I think we should all try to make a pact that, is it really a crisis if we know it's coming? It sort of undercuts the central meaning of the word crisis. But I think we need to move on from that somehow. But I think the president is making a strong political stand here, and if Republicans don't like it, that means it's probably working.
What do you make of the fact that we've come this close to the sequester politically? Like you say, a manufactured crisis. It was designed in 2011 to avoid a manufactured crisis in a way, when Congress and the president couldn't come to a longer-term budget and deficit reduction plan, to make the alternative so unpalatable that both sides would be forced to do something. But now the politics seem to be that they're going to stalemate again and allow the unpalatable by design cuts to take effect. Is this a sign of politics being broken this badly in Washington, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, this has happened twice before in somewhat recent history, and it ended up with a pretty good result. So that's I don't mean to be Panglossian about it, but there are two examples. One was way back in the George H.W. Bush administration. Remember, we had Graham Rudman, which passed in 86, I think, which said, you know, if you had budget cuts, you had to find the revenue. You had to have a balanced budget, and it forced in that only Bush term a near showdown. And ultimately, we got a pretty good fiscal policy out of that, which cost George Bush's job in many ways.
Because that was the tax hike that followed "Read my lips, no new taxes."
Right, and then he said "Read my hips," which was not as eloquent or resonant politically. But that worked. And then in 1995, whatever one thinks of Newt Gingrich, and there's a lot to think about him, by forcing the government shutdown, what the Gingrich and the House Republicans did then, which was really what set up Clinton's true political comeback in the middle of the 90s, you know, Gingrich took Reaganism to its logical extreme. You know, Republicans had said forever they hated government, but federal spending rose in the 1980s under President Reagan. So Gingrich, for whatever set of motives, actually said, all right, well, let's see if you really don't want it. And guess what? It turned out that Americans did want all those services that President Obama just listed. So we've been to this movie before. The difference, I think, now, which goes straight to your question, is we now see these movies every other month.
Right.
And I do think it's going to have ultimately a corrosive effect on and a dulling effect on the public, which is going to have a very hard time figuring out which crisis we're in at the moment.
Americans want 100% of the government services that they want for 75% of the taxes. And so we're going to keep having these conflicts. But the president keeps talking about a balanced approach, his phrase, to this $100 billion or so that the sequester represents. He wants to have more revenue by limiting loopholes and tax deductions, plus some spending cuts, his balanced approach. But the Republicans point out he never puts spending cuts on the table, just requests for more revenue. Why isn't the president getting specific about the details of a balanced deal that he says he wants if he's appealing to the American public to really stay on his side?
My sense is that insofar as the president's not been as specific as he should be, for there to be, and you know this as well or better than I do, what we're really talking about when we talk about spending cuts is we're talking about entitlement reform. We're talking about Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security,
which are excluded from the sequestration. It's everything but.
Right. And so what we're arguing about then is one of the things I try to do is whenever somebody says, oh, if only we could cut spending, I'll say, well, what you really mean is if we could really cut discretionary spending, which is 12% of the budget. If you take defense and the major, largely middle class entitlement programs off the table, then you're really talking about, you know, the idea that you can go after Big Bird and balance the budget is one of the great canards in American politics.
Or air traffic controllers or anything else that was on that list that the president recited.
Yeah. Now, those are important functions. But, you know, as James Baker used to say, you got to hunt where the ducks are. And the real revenue ducks are in largely income transfer payments that touch not poor people, not just airplane passengers, not just people whose houses are suddenly on fire, not just parents of children who may be in subsidized daycare, but the broad, broad mass of the country and people who, in their own minds, don't see themselves as part of this spending problem. They see themselves as taxpayers who don't want to pay so much taxes, but then tend not to look at what their own complicity in this issue, which is to, you know, the folks who, for, yes, it was promised, but the folks who on Social Security, the folks on Medicare, you, as you remember, the greatest sign, arguably of the 20, the greatest political sign, arguably the greatest of the 21st century, was at a anti-Obama rally during the health care debate where someone held up a sign and said, I want the government to stay out of my Medicare.
Right.
You know, and so when that's what you're dealing with, you know, it's kind of dizzying. What I think,
I like the sign, by the way, at a different rally that said, we'll know a corporation is a person when Texas executes one.
Exactly.
But that's another show.
That's another show. So I think that the president is the president perfect in this? Lord, no. I think that, and in fact, you know, he ran for the job now twice. And part of presidential leadership is dealing with recalcitrant congressmen who say they, you know, are always interested in the big picture, but in point of fact are not. I could, you know, if we could beam George Washington, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson into the room right now, they would have similar tales to tell. What you hope is that a crisis, which a moment of tension, a showdown where the alternative seems so disastrous, does lead to some kind of forced wisdom. What I find frustrating, and I'm sure you do too, is if you talk to any politician, not any, but 8 politicians out of 10, if you get them away from a microphone and go totally off the record and say, how do you fix this? They can all tell you in about 2 minutes or less, right? It involves a cost of living adjustment and some means testing on Social Security. It involves the retirement and Medicare age. It's not terribly difficult to get a significant part of this under control. I don't mean that it's not painful, but the policy shifts that are required are not terribly complicated. And the failure, it seems to me, of the president and of both and of the Republicans to have that conversation in an honest way is one of the things that I find sort of head-scratching, particularly for President Obama, who is someone who so values the role of data and reason. And I've just been puzzled by his inability or his unwillingness, let me put it that way, because he's certainly able to do it, to use Simpson Bowles, to use that sort of plan, at least as an educational tool.
My guest, and we're almost out of time, with John Meacham, executive editor at Random House, former editor-in-chief of Newsweek. Many of you watched him as co-host of Need to Know on PBS. His latest book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. And, John, just before you go, we have Al Gore coming up on today's show, and I know you have edited him. Did you edit his new book, The Future?
I did. It was a great pleasure. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's so impressive to me that rather than sit back and write a self-serving memoir, as many former politicians do, he has tried to write the great American nonfiction book, which tries to encompass literally all the biggest challenges facing humankind for the next century and leave it out there as a document. So do you want to leave us with any thought about that or where he's coming from?
I would love to. I totally agree with you. I think he's a unique figure in the life of the nation and the life of the world. He could be doing a lot of other things with his time. I've never, you know, I've been in journalism and publishing for 20 years or more, and I've never met, and forget writers who are also public figures. I've never met a writer who worked harder on doing the research, getting it right, telling the story than Al Gore did in this book. This was a huge, heavy intellectual and storytelling lift. I certainly wouldn't have tried it. You know, I just do dead white guys. So at least I know where my story ends. He wanted to take this comprehensive view, and it's Al Gore at his best. You know, he connects things that mere mortals like us would not connect. And I think it's a vital book.
And we talked to Al Gore and more on today's show as we continue here on The Brian Lehrer Show. And we thank John Meacham, who I didn't know until he just told me, is the editor of Al Gore's book, The Future, author of his own books, including Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. And he's executive editor at Random House these days. John, thanks for lending a little wisdom on the D.C. scene.
I'm not sure it's wisdom, but it can't hurt.
Thanks again.
Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.